The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is your producer, Sam Livingston. I'm filling in today for Mr. Fleury, along with the other guest hosts that we've had over the past week. On today's show, we'll cover a variety of different topics, hopefully some topics that you'll find fun and enjoyable, some lighter topics towards the end about sports. We'll begin today's show with some questions about the arrest of Julian Assange last week. That was big news. In the second segment, I'll play some clips from Mr. Gerald Fleury's latest or second latest Key of David program, the one about the college admissions scandal. And in the final segment, I've got a few comments about Tiger Woods' comeback at the Masters tournament on Sunday. So hopefully you'll stick around for that fun bit at the end there. Let's go ahead and hop into it here. The big news last week, right at the end of the week, I think it was Thursday night, maybe Friday morning, was the arrest of Julian Assange. He's the founder of WikiLeaks. He is notorious for publishing government secrets and other hacked or stolen information. You've undoubtedly heard about WikiLeaks and all of the scandals that they've been involved in. And it was a pretty vague arrest. He's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy for 7 or 8 years now. Suddenly one day they stopped giving him that asylum. The police went in there, dragged him out. And there are a lot of questions swirling around now. There's a lot of drama circulating in the news. And there are a lot of questions that are going unanswered. So let's give some context. Let's see why it's important to look at what's happening and how this will be drummed up in the American media. So some bit of context here. What's actually more interesting about the arrest of Julian Assange is what he is not being tried for, what he was not arrested for, as we'll get to in a few minutes here. Back in 2010, there was the arrest of Bradley Manning, now goes by the name Chelsea Manning. He worked for the military, he stole government secrets, and then he worked with Julian Assange to publish them online. So Julian Assange took those that big document, hundreds of thousands of files, created WikiLeaks, and posted all of these secret documents there online. And this was a huge deal 10 years ago. These men were enemies of the state. They were leakers publishing government secrets. But the media, they were heroes. Now, some of that information was very insightful. It was very revealing. It was very frightening to know what the government was doing. But a lot of it also jeopardized American troops. It put American service members at risk. These men were traitors. Now, Bradley Manning, who was serving in the military, he was caught and sentenced by the Obama administration to 35 years in jail. And right at the end of his administration there, as his outgoing move, I think this was January 18th or 19th of 2017, Mr. Obama commutated Bradley Manning's sentence, or shortened his sentence. Assange, he was holed up in London. He had been in London for 7 or 8 years, staying only in the Ecuadorian embassy. Now, Julian Assange did not steal the information himself. He just published it, which raises a lot of questions about how he should be treated. Is he a journalist? Is he a journalist the same way a journalist is at the Washington Post or New York Times? When they get a leak, it doesn't matter how they got it. Often they just say it's from an anonymous source and they go ahead and publish it. Now, Julian Assange, he published very sensitive information, stolen information, but he was praised by a lot of the media 8 or 9 years ago for exposing the government. This is a Washington Post article. This is February 2011. It's titled, Why the United States Shouldn't Try Julian Assange. It says, a conviction would also cause collateral damage to American media freedoms. It is difficult to distinguish Assange or WikiLeaks from the Washington Post. National security reporters for the Post solicit and receive classified information regularly, and the Post regularly publishes it. The Obama administration has suggested it can prosecute Assange without impinging on press freedoms by charging him not with publishing classified information, but with conspiring with Bradley Manning, the alleged government leaker, to steal and share the information. News reports suggest that this theory is falling apart because the government cannot find evidence that Assange induced Bradley to leak. Even if it could, such evidence would not distinguish the many American journalists who actively aid leakers of classified information. So this is the Washington Post, 2011, defending Assange. He's a journalist, they said. And that's the view they had for a few years. And then you get to the election of 2016 and everything changes. Now everyone looks at Julian Assange through the eyes of the 2016 election, through the election of Mr. Donald Trump, through the lens of Russia hacking. So if you look back at 2016, you have Russia hacks the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's company, publishes the DNC emails. And all of this, we are told, for the past 3 years, is part of a conspiracy scandal to help get Mr. Donald Trump elected president. So now Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are the enemy for conspiring with Russia to help Trump. So 2016 changes everything. Never mind the whole thing about how the press loved Assange for uncovering government corruption, which he did expose corruption. The DNC actually had it in for Hillary Clinton. They favored Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders, and that's what those emails exposed. And they said, well, that's unfairly influencing the election in favor of Donald Trump. So for 3 years, we're left believing Russia hacked the DNC, that it colluded with WikiLeaks, who then colluded with the Trump campaign in order to influence the 2016 election. We've gone over this many times before. And there are just a few things here that Andrew McCarthy points out that make this story even more interesting. So over the past 2 years, we've had Robert Mueller's investigation, and he's indicted Russians. You'll hear about how he has so many indictments. Well, the vast majority of them are Russians. So when Mueller indicts a Russian, it's more of a publicity stunt. There is no international law that compels that Russian individual or entity from ever having to appear in a U.S. courtroom. So because Mueller indicts all of these Russians, I think it was something like 13 or 14, it proves there's obviously collusion. But like I said, there's no way to ever get these Russians to show up in court. So it never goes to trial. Nothing is ever proven. The evidence doesn't actually have to be disclosed. We never learn about any of the evidence. What we know about is that the Russians were indicted. And as we'll see towards the end of this segment, that was mainly a publicity stunt to keep this story alive, to keep it circulating, to make it look as though Mueller was onto something. So he indicts these Russians, and then one of them actually decides to send a lawyer to represent himself against Mueller's prosecutors. This was very embarrassing for Mueller's team. They weren't prepared to go to court. And obviously, when this Russian sent his lawyer there, they wanted discovery. They wanted to know, well, how did you uncover the facts here? We want to see the evidence. We want to know the case that you're building against us. And Mueller's team refused to hand it over. And it should have refused to hand it over, because giving that information to someone over in Russia who you have no control of is probably going to leak all of that stuff. those are American secrets that are being leaked. But this shows, or this proves, that Mueller really wasn't prepared to try this case. And it raises a lot of questions. Well, what evidence is there? What's at the core of this Russian hack story? And that's essentially where it is now. It's in limbo, these prosecutions or these indictments against the Russians. But we haven't actually seen the concrete, hard evidence saying or proving this collusion between Russia and WikiLeaks the way we were told. The FBI never did see the servers at the DNC. We know now, beyond a doubt, Mueller's report is done and there was no collusion with the Trump campaign. But none of that ever went to court. There's never any evidence presented. We never saw anything that would actually really prove like the core elements of this story. The FBI, the intelligence agencies, they rushed together a report and they had the foundation of this narrative. Russia hacked the DNC. They gave the emails to WikiLeaks, who talked to the Trump campaign, and they leaked it. That was the story. And those are kind of the foundational elements. And you don't hear a lot of people go back to that origin story. Well, where did that even come from? And then last week, we get to the biggest colluder of them all, Julian Assange. He is this pivot point. Russia hacks the DNC. They have the emails. They give them to WikiLeaks, who is Julian Assange's organization. And then WikiLeaks tells the Trump campaign ahead of time, hey, we've got all these emails. We're going to dump them. We're doing it to help you. Well, none of that happened. But now, you see in 2010, 2011, WikiLeaks, they're praised. Julian Assange, he's a journalist. You can't prosecute him. He has freedom of speech, freedom of the press. Then 2016, he's colluding with President Trump. He's a traitor. He's colluding with Russia. He's a stooge of Vladimir Putin. And then he's arrested. He's arrested last week. And he's not being charged for anything having to do with Russia. He's not being charged on any conspiracies against the U.S. government that have to do with Russia. He's not being charged for stealing those DNC emails. He's not being charged for colluding with the Trump campaign. So here is this man, like a core piece of the entire narrative. He is that middleman. Part in this conspiracy that we've been told to believe the past 2 or 3 years. And that's the point that Andrew McCarthy brings out in his article on Monday. It's titled, "Why Isn't Assange Charged with Collusion with Russia?" He says, "England is a close ally, but getting its courts to extradite people for U.S. criminal proceedings is no layup. It's a laborious process, and the outcome, even in strong cases, is uncertain. The Justice Department knows this, yet in its indictment, it elected not to charge the Russia conspiracy, a 2016 offense that has no statute of limitations problem. Why? If you want the Brits to transfer a defendant, you need to make a compelling showing. Why leave obvious, serious charges on the cutting room floor? Mueller brought a dozen felony charges against the Russian operatives, with whom we've been told for 2 years Assange conspired. So why isn't Assange charged with at least some of these felonies? Why did Mueller indict those Russians on these charges of collusion, of colluding, actually working with Julian Assange, and then Julian Assange gets arrested, and none of these charges are there? There are questions about his freedom, his press freedom, like we covered earlier. But the Justice Department could make an argument that there's no First Amendment right to steal secret information from the government. That is not covered in the First Amendment. McCarthy goes on, "If this is the Justice Department's position, then why not charge Assange with the 2016 collusion conspiracy too?" So he's already being charged for conspiracy against the U.S. government for what he did with Bradley Manning. Why not just throw in the Russia collusion in 2016 as well? McCarthy goes on, if I were a cynic, I'd suspect that the government does not want Special Counsel Mueller's Russian hacking indictment to be challenged. So, Assange is arrested. If he's charged for Russia conspiracy, Russia collusion, it means he gets to go to a courtroom. It means he gets to defend himself. It means he gets a lawyer. It means they have to go back through discovery again, just like the other Russians or that one Russian did last year. Now, McCarthy says Russia likely did commit this hack. They probably did give those emails to the DNC, but why are they afraid to have to present this evidence in a courtroom, even if it's sealed, even if it stays hidden from the public? McCarthy continues, the intelligence assessment here may be sound, but the legal case Mueller would have to prove to a jury has problems. To state the most obvious, the Justice Department and FBI did not perform elementary investigative steps, such as taking possession of and performing their own forensic analysis on the servers that were hacked. Instead, they relied on CrowdStrike, a contractor of the DNC, which has a strong motive to blame Russia. So it's very likely that they're worried if this gets challenged, if this is taken before a judge, that they might not have the evidence they actually need to have it hold up. Consequently, McCarthy continues, if Assange were charged with the Russian hacking conspiracy that Mueller has alleged, and if he were ever brought to the U.S. to face trial, he would maintain that he did not get the Democratic emails from Russian intelligence. Remember, a defendant does not have to prove anything. It would not be Assange's burden to establish Russia's innocence. The Justice Department would have to prove Russia's culpability. So they've been accusing all of these people. They've been indicting them. They've been accusing them for the past 2 years. And the presumption of innocence isn't there because, well, they're in Russia. They're not going to come over here, so we don't even have to try to prove it in court. But if they do come over, sorry, the presumption of innocence is there for the defendant. You can't accuse someone of something and then bring them to you and say, well, you have to prove to me that you didn't do it. At least that's not the way it works in America. The prosecutor has to prove that that person did it. So if Assange is brought before the court and he's being tried on this Russia collusion conspiracy, it's up to Mueller's team, it's up to the government to prove that it happened. And McCarthy's wondering, well, do they even have the evidence? Can they even make that case? McCarthy says, to sum up, if the Justice Department had indicted Assange for collusion, Mueller's Russian hacking indictment would no longer stand unchallenged. Are they afraid for this narrative to go challenged? Are they afraid to bring it before a judge that might say, the evidence doesn't hold up? Now, it's very unlikely that we'll ever find out these elements of the story. This goes back to the summer of 2016. It'll be interesting to see what the Attorney General William Barr uncovers and some of the other Inspector General's reports. But it's very funny that Mueller could be so aggressive at the start, indicting foreign companies, indicting foreign individuals, expecting them never to appear in court, and then when one finally does, they panic. But now you've got a similar thing happening with Assange. Well, just don't charge him with that. And he's at the center of this whole conspiracy theory we've been fed for the past 2 years. Remember, Roger Stone, he was investigated for direct messaging Julian Assange. As it happened, everyone else in the press wanted to do the same thing. Everyone else in the media wanted to find out where these emails were because Julian Assange had tweeted about it. So this wasn't exactly a secret, but Roger Stone was being investigated for talking to him. And then he got rung up through a process crime, and there was a raid on his house. the 6 a.m. raid for his involvement in the Trump campaign. And his involvement, the sketchy involvement that he had, was talking to Julian Assange. And now Julian Assange is arrested, and there's nothing about Russia conspiracy. McCarthy concludes his article. Meanwhile, let us remember, despite a dearth of evidence that he was complicit in Moscow's hacking, President Trump was forced by the Justice Department and the FBI, urged on by congressional Democrats, to endure a 2-year investigation and to govern under a cloud of suspicion that he was an agent of the Kremlin. Now we have Assange, as to whom there is indisputable evidence of complicity in the hacking conspiracy. But the Justice Department declines to charge him with it, instead positing the dubious Manning conspiracy that may very well be time-barred. He concludes, what is going on here? What is happening? They have their man. They have the central figure. It is indisputable. WikiLeaks published those documents in 2016. Everybody knows it. And now they have the man behind it, and there's nothing. There's no conspiracy charge. Matt Tabby, he works for Rolling Stone, obviously a left-leaning publication, but he's had some interesting articles the past couple of weeks about the Mueller investigation and freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and just the government getting too large in general. This article he wrote on April 11th is titled Why the Assange Arrest Should Scare Reporters, and he kind of takes the approach that the Washington Post had 6 or 7 years ago. Well, we shouldn't go after Assange because he's a journalist like we are, but the conclusion of his article, he makes some good points. He says, not only did this case have nothing to do with Russiagate, but in one of the odder, unreported details of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, he never interviewed or attempted to interview Assange. In fact, it appears none of the 2,800 subpoenas, 500 witness interviews, and 500 search warrants in the Mueller probe targeted Assange or WikiLeaks. That is weird. That is strange, considering they're at the center of this narrative that the media has been feeding the American public for 2.5 years. Russia, WikiLeaks, Trump, WikiLeaks, Russia, whatever combination you want. It's these three all working together, all colluding to undermine, to influence the 2016 election and to give the victory to Donald Trump. We know it's a hoax now. But the fact that Assange isn't being tried on it is just another proof. It's another proof that it's not there. The story is not there. They're not willing to try it in court. Matt Tabby continues, according to WikiLeaks, no one from Mueller's office ever attempted to get a statement from Assange, any WikiLeaks employee, or any of Assange's lawyers. A Senate committee did reach out to Assange last year about the possibility of testifying, but never followed up. As Pollack told me in February, Assange has not been contacted by the Office of the Special Counsel or the House. There was a Senate inquiry, he said, but it was only an exploratory conversation and has not resulted in any agreement for Mr. Assange to be interviewed. Throughout the winter, I asked officials and former prosecutors why officials wouldn't be interested in at least getting a statement from a person ostensibly at the center of an all-consuming international controversy. There were many explanations offered, the least curious being that Assange's earlier charges, assuming they existed, could pose legal and procedural obstacles. Now that Assange's extant case has finally been made public, the concern on that score dissipates, as one legal expert put it today. It will therefore be interesting to see if Assange is finally asked about Russiagate by someone in American officialdom. If he isn't, that will be yet another curious detail in a case that gets stranger by the minute. And And that's kind of the response that I had Thursday or Friday. What's going on? How did this suddenly happen after 7 or 8 years? This is, like he says there, a man at the center of an all-consuming international controversy. And this comes right after Mueller files his report. There was no collusion. And here's a man right at the center of it all, and no one's asking any questions. It'll be interesting to see how much about this whole story we learn, how much about the origins we learn. How was this started back in 2016? What did this relationship even exist between Russia and WikiLeaks, as we're told it did? How much of this will be exposed? Mr. Gerald Flurry writes in Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. He says, for 8 years under President Obama, the forces of the radical left were on the march, virtually unchecked. Even Republican leaders caved in, and that was after they had taken control of Congress and had a lot of power to stop the president. Donald Trump has proved himself willing to take a stand where others have not. It is quite something to behold him resisting these anti-American forces. He has inspired a few other leaders to challenge the radical left and help expose it for what it is. And then remember that article he wrote earlier in 2018 about the Nunes memo. He says, this memo exposes a conspiracy within these government agencies to undermine candidate Trump's presidential campaign. A conspiracy. And now we're learning even more about that hoax. We're learning even more about that plot, that coup attempt. And now I guess the question is, how much will we learn? How far back will it go? How much will be exposed? We'll go ahead and take a quick break, and next we will get into some audio clips from Mr. Flurry's recent Key of David program.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. In a recent Key of David program, Mr. Gerald Flurry talked about the college admissions scandal. Dozens of parents paying off colleges with bribes to accept their children who really did not qualify to attend those schools. But it's all about the label. It's all about the diploma. And really, what sort of education is that? You go there for 4 years and you come out and you can say you're an alumni of University of Southern California or Harvard or Yale, but you bribe someone to get there. And Mr. Flurry has some really incredible sound bites from that Key of David. It's a really moving topic, and he's very passionate about it and how it undermines the rule of law and just the entire really fabric of American society. In America, the diploma or the degree from that Ivy League school, it's almost like you're deified when you get something like that. Nothing can stop you. You can have any job you want. And now we're learning just how, well, pathetic and moth-eaten that whole industry is. It looks so nice on the surface, but it's just corruption through and through. We'll go ahead and just play a soundbite from that recent Key of David titled No Freedom Without Law.
That is an incredible and stunning statement that he has just made here. He concludes by saying all of this has significant social ramifications. Of course, it means that our meritocracy doesn't begin in college. It ends for many upon admission to college. In other words, the real education never even begins. But you, create a certain merit from all of this just because of the prestige of these universities. But he said that these young people expect to be pampered, and their parents expect them to be pampered, and they don't want honest grades.
Sorry, I meant to mention that he's quoting an article from Ben Shapiro about the admissions scandal. But some of those statements in that soundbite, the real education never begins. They're going after the prestige of these universities. People expect to be pampered. They're not working to get into these colleges. They're just paying their way into it. They're buying a label. And that label gets them a job, and they go unchallenged. They're not really educated. They're just getting the diploma. One more clip from Mr. Fleury's recent Key of David program.
That, but again, these students are simply not challenged. How can you get an A education if you're not challenged? I'm the chancellor of a college, and I'm telling you, it's not that way here, and it shouldn't be that way any place.
I love that. They're not being challenged. I'm the chancellor of a college, and I'm telling you, it's not that way here, and it shouldn't be that way any place. Young people are not being challenged, and that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit in this segment. They're not getting the education that they need. They're not prepared for work. They're not prepared for life. I saw this article in the National Review. This was Monday. It's titled, Go to a Cheap College or None at All. It says, in an era when the obsession over getting into an elite college seems stronger than ever, it's good to know that some companies don't seem to care much about the higher education hierarchy. But why should they care about it at all? A lot of them, they look at these graduates, and the college for them is just a screening process. They want to see, is the student diligent? Are they going to persevere through the program? The way this article makes it seem like they don't even look at their grades. They just want to see, are they going to stick to the program? Are they disciplined? And it doesn't matter if it's a bachelor's degree from a community college or some elite university. A lot of these low-level employers, they understand that they're going to have to go through a lot of training with any new employee. But they want someone that they know works hard. So it really doesn't matter to them where you went to college. They just want to see that you did it. But then on the other hand, a lot of these employers don't even care. They know that they're going to have to train these entry-level individuals anyway. So it really just undermines a lot of this institution, a lot of the glamour and the glitz of what we've been sold as these great universities preparing everyone for the workplace. And these students go into debt, tens of thousands of dollars to go to even just these state universities. I think when I was graduating high school, I looked at, they have counselors and they're always telling you about what your options are, and they're presenting all of these different things to you, and there's there's like Northwestern and University of Illinois. And every time I looked at something like that, it's like $40,000 a year. Maybe in some places it's like that a semester. And I just thought, there is no way I could ever do something like that. I just could, the idea of starting out with that much debt. Now, I know in some fields that's an investment. In some fields you have to get that sort of education. But you, it's sold to you like if you don't have this, you go nowhere in life. And the irony is that a lot of these colleges, they're not producing capable young adults. They're producing pampered young people, young adults, the safe spacers. And how as an employer, do you employ someone like that? How do you employ these individuals that want to be pampered? How do you train someone that doesn't believe they can be wrong? How do you train someone that only believes their truth and that their truth is superior to fact and to reason? And it's definitely superior to your truth. As a business owner, how do you bring your vision to life? It's your business. It's your investment. It's your business. How do you bring that to fruition if you can only find employees who think their vision is as or more important than yours? And it there is actually a lot of panic about this now. A lot of the maybe 50s, 60s, the baby boomers are worried. We can't employ people like this. They don't work the way that they should. And a lot of this, it's self-made. You know, these are the children of the truth is relative generations. And these are the products of these institutions and these teaching methods that we've cherished for so long. And now it gets to this point and we're all wondering, well, where did this come from? What do you mean you don't want to hear words you don't like? A lot of it gets back to family. A lot of it is happening at the schools. Anyway, I saw this clip the other day and I thought it was a bit refreshing. Maybe some of you watch college basketball. I usually try to keep up with the big March Madness tournament. It's a 64-team single elimination tournament. It happens each year. It's called March Madness. High intensity, high drama. And this year there was quite a stir about how a coach, his name is Tom Izzo, he's the coach of the Michigan State University basketball team, he yelled at his player on the court in the middle of a game. And I'm not endorsing, you know, this coach's methods or the way he did it. Maybe he could have used a little more tact in doing it. But at the end of the day, this was a coach yelling at his player for doing something wrong. And this is in the biggest tournament of the year where you lose one game, one slip up, and you're out and you have to wait until next season. So there was this heated moment where this player was jogging back and he should have been sprinting. And the coach called a timeout. Tom Izzo called a timeout and he was really yelling at him. You need to move. You have to hustle. And then after the game, there's this big controversy. Should coaches be yelling at their players like that? Is it right for the coach to be so mean? And it was a bit ridiculous, I thought. I mean, even watching the video, he seemed pretty tame compared to other coaches I've seen in the past in college sports, in professional sports, even coaches I've experienced in elementary school when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. And it's part of this idea that, well, you go to college and you should be pampered. You should be taken care of. Now, Izzo was challenging his player. He was challenging him to run faster. And I saw this clip on ESPN. I thought it was interesting, this panel talking about this quote-unquote controversy about a coach yelling at their player. And it was a bit refreshing to actually hear common sense on ESPN. But I'll just play you a bit of this clip and what one of these panelists was saying about this incident.
It's one thing to be outplayed. It's another thing to jog back in a one-and-done tournament. He's holding the kid responsible. Look, this is a problem I have I have a problem the way we treat college athletes sometimes as though they're professional athletes. Yes, they know what they're signing up for. They're playing in huge arenas. Stephen A., as you mentioned, you know, packed arenas. They're playing in front of millions of people. But they're not professional athletes, and they are still kids, right? So, but this does not cross that line. That's one. Two, I have a problem with the way people view college generally. The idea that college is a vocational school, and obviously in the case of big-time sports, it is, right? Preparing you to do what you're going to do for a living. To me, that's what, for most people, that's what graduate school should be. College should be about becoming a more fully formed person, becoming an adult and understanding your world in an important way. And this is part of a student-athlete's experience. It should be. This is part of learning what it is to be responsible. To, yes, to be reprimanded in front of millions of people if you screwed up and you know what's at stake. I really do not have a problem with what Izzo did here.
It's about becoming a more fully formed person. I loved his comments about what college is about. It's to prepare you for the world, not to coddle you, not to pamper you. You pay to go there, and you're being prepared for life in the world. You're being prepared to deal with failure. You're being prepared to deal with correction. You're being prepared to deal with uncomfortable situations. You are forced out of your comfort zone. You're forced to grow. And I bet he was probably out of his comfort zone when he was being yelled at, but I bet he ran harder. Just hearing that clip, it made me very thankful for God's College. It made me very thankful for that clip of Mr. Gerald Fleury in that Key of David saying, these students are simply not challenged. How can you get any education if you're not challenged? He says, I'm the chancellor of a college, and I'm telling you it's not that way here, and it shouldn't be that way any place. Are we afraid to be challenged? Are we afraid to be pushed out of our comfort zone? And that, I mean, it's laughable today, this idea of these safe spaces and these zones where you can't tell people the truth, or you can't even be in those areas if you don't believe what they believe. It's such a strange idea, but it is something that we all kind of have. It's not manifested in that way, but we like our safe space. We like the comfort zone. We like where the area where we don't have to be pushed. We like the area where we don't have to be yelled at. We like the area where we don't have to take any risks. But how else do you grow? You have to be challenged. You have to push yourself out of that area. And this coach, to his credit, is not buying into that. And when you play a sport, it's on full display. It's very evident when a team does bad. It's very evident when they aren't pushing themselves, when they aren't being challenged, because they're going to lose. And when they start losing, people are going to start wondering, well, what's happening? What's going wrong? What aren't you doing? And a lot of it gets down to, in our own lives, we're not challenging ourselves. We're not pushing ourselves the way that we should. It's really made me a lot more thankful for Armstrong College and that pressure cooker environment that you're put through. And I've talked to other graduates and friends of mine, and some of them are being promoted at work. And it's not because they have some specified skill set that makes them, you know, so much smarter than anyone else, but they know how to manage. They know how to speak. They know how to lead. They know how to conduct themselves, and they're being rewarded for that. They're being promoted because they went to a college that taught them how to live. They went to a college that wanted to create adults ready for life, to teach them how to live. And there is no other school on earth that teaches those skills like Herbert W. Armstrong College. So I just enjoyed looking at that. I enjoyed thinking about that segment and what Mr. Armstrong has written about true education. If you haven't seen it, go ahead and go back and watch that Key of David from Mr. Gerald Fleury. It's titled No Freedom Without Law. We'll take one short break here and then conclude with a segment about Tiger Woods.
Music.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Many doubted we'd ever see it, but here it is. The return to glory.
At 18, Tiger completes one of the greatest comebacks in Masters history. One of the greatest comebacks in sports history. He wins his fifth green jacket.
Many doubted we'd ever see it, but here it is. That was as Tiger Woods sunk that last putt on the 18th hole and won the Masters on Sunday. And I think everyone knows the name Tiger Woods, and he won his fifth Masters. This was his 15th major tournament victory on Sunday. He's 43 years old, and I've never seen so much excitement and anticipation for golf before. My grandfather and my neighbor, they were really into golf. They're always watching golf. It was so boring to me growing up, and it never looked that exciting. But then I was watching some highlights from the Masters, and I couldn't believe how big the crowd was. I couldn't believe how many people were talking about this tournament. And when he won, you heard a bit of the crowd there. It sounded they were celebrating like a Super Bowl victory. Normally it's the polite little golf clap, but people are flailing their arms up in the air. There must have been a couple thousand people around him at that last hole. Really a dramatic and exciting scene. And like the commentator said there, probably one of the best moments in sports history. And what makes this victory, what makes his winning that tournament so exciting is a lot to do with the backstory. Now, obviously every person in the world there, we all have our faults. We all have things that we go through, and there are certainly elements of a lot of athletes' lives that we never glorify. A lot of them set a terrible example in their personal lives, but there are always lessons to take from an athlete who is the best at their profession, who perseveres, who puts in the time and the energy and becomes the greatest at what they do. I'd just like to talk about this lesson of perseverance to conclude today's show. Here's a clip from one of Mr. Armstrong's visits. I think this was when he was in Japan, and he was talking about the seven laws of success, and he talks about this sixth law, the sixth law of perseverance.
Now, the sixth law of success, then, is sticking to it and never giving up and never quitting, or perseverance. We should never give up. Many people have given up and quit when if they had just stayed on a little longer, their lives might have been a great success.
If they had just stayed on a little longer, their lives might have been a great success. Tiger Woods, he's been golfing since he was a toddler. He became a professional when he was 20. That was back in 1996. Maybe you'll remember some of his fun Nike commercials about how easy golf is. I very much disagree with him. He quickly became the best in the world. He was getting all sorts of sponsors. He was winning tournament after tournament. I think he was the first golfer to win all four of the major tournaments in a row. And then in 2008, for 10, 12 years, I always heard about Tiger Woods as a kid. He was on almost like every cereal box. And it was so funny to me because I never watched this sport, but you always knew who Tiger Woods was. And then in 2008, he won his last major tournament. And then he had a lot of personal scandals that went public, a lot of terrible sins and things that he got into. He went through a divorce, and he was just a terrible example of, you know, an athlete as great as he was, but not getting things right at home. And this was a huge low point. And then he's plagued by injuries throughout all of that time. Leg injuries, injuries in his elbows, his wrists. He's constantly having to take breaks from playing golf. And then by 2010, it was kind of like he was just fading out. He went through all of these scandals. He lost a lot of his sponsors. He couldn't recover from injuries. And it was just like, for me personally, I just kind of thought, well, that's the end of Tiger Woods. You're not going to hear about him anymore. It's just going to fade into history. He was that great golfer whose career ended with scandals and with injuries. And I had always just kind of put him out of mind. And then in 2017, he was ranked 1,199th in the world. So he's about as far down as you could be. He has hit rock bottom. He's in this low point. He's washed up. And it looked like he was just going to fade away. His career was done. But he kept going. He kept playing golf. He kept pushing himself. He made a lot of changes in his personal life. When he won this tournament on Sunday, he ran over and embraced his son. He was hugging his mom. And it seems like he really worked hard to get his family and personal life back in order. And what really made this victory special for him, he said, was all of the years building up to it, all of the turmoil that he had gone through. It had been 11 years since his last victory, 11 years. He'd gone from winning all of those tournaments, I think 14 major tournaments, just dozens of other smaller ones. And then for 11 years, he didn't win any major tournaments. The New York Times headline, Tiger Woods and a stirring return to the top captures the Masters at 43. At 43, Woods became the second oldest winner of the Masters behind Jack Nicklaus, who won there in 1986 at age 46. And Tiger Woods was also the youngest person to win the Masters. He won when he was 21. The New York Times says, the win even led to a rare moment of agreement between President Trump and former President Barack Obama. What a fantastic life comeback for a really great guy, the president said on Twitter. To come back and win the Masters after all the highs and lows is a testament to excellence, grit, and determination, Obama posted. And the New York Times just goes through how epic this victory was in the years leading up to it, like I covered at the beginning there with his drama and his personal life, his physical injuries. And then at this tournament, it was nice to see him at the end running over. He had both his kids there running over and embracing them afterwards. And then just to see that crowd as excited as they were was really touching, considering all that this man has been through the past 10 or 12 years. A lot of it self-inflicted. But again, that lesson still stands. He didn't just say, that's the end of it. I've given up. No one's going to watch me golf again. I'm never going to be a great golfer. I've got too many injuries. My reputation is tarnished because of the mistakes that I made. He just kept plugging away. And it's a neat lesson for us to learn about perseverance, to just keep pushing through it, like Mr. Armstrong said. I'll just conclude today's program with one clip. This was Tiger Woods' interview after he won the Masters, and he has some comments about just getting up and fighting and persevering.
People have struggles in their lives. They have personal struggles, physical struggles. You've overcome these things. What message might you say to people who are struggling? What encouragement would you give them not to give up, to say that you can possibly overcome these issues?
Well, you never give up. That's a given. You always fight, and that just giving up's never an equation. Granted, pushing and being competitive has got me into this position, but it's also what got me out of it. And so I've always had a pretty good work ethic throughout my career and throughout my life, and I just had to change the work ethic a bit and work on some different things. And so, you know, focused on that and just keep fighting. That's just part of the deal. We wake up every morning and there's always challenges in front of us, and keep fighting and keep getting through them.
I love that. Giving up is never in the equation. It's not even considered. And how much more so should that be in our own lives? He says, just keep fighting. That's part of the deal. I like that bit. It's just part of the deal. This is what you signed up for. It's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a fight. We wake up every morning and there's always challenges. Just keep fighting and keep getting through them. There are always challenges, just like we covered earlier. You have to push through those challenges. And this was a neat illustration of that. It was neat to see him come back after all those years. He didn't choose to just fade away into history. He actually kept pressing on and won this tournament. That's all I have time for today. Thank you for listening to today's show. I believe we'll have Brent on the show tomorrow, and then hopefully Mr. Fleury will either be back Friday or Monday. Thanks again for listening.